Hello and welcome to a special episode of Football Memories and Moments. We've taken the decision to put out this special episode because we've had a look around and everyone else is doing a best of a series. So we thought, well, you know, why not be sheep and do it as well? We've got nothing else to do on a Monday night. Only Connect and University Challenge are finished. Did very well, thanks for asking. And we thought we'd just put together the best of Series 3, which includes the likes of Tom Williams, Duncan Alexander, Kevin Day, Amy Lawrence, with some excellent chats. We'll probably try and do this for Series 1 and 2 as well. But for now, here's the best of Series 3, and we'll hope that that will push you on to go and have a listen to the rest of Series 3. Okay, thanks. Bye now.
Brazil, I was very conscious of the little boy in me who had fallen in love with football during the 1990 World Cup and just become completely obsessed with the sport in the space of a few weeks. And yeah, you know, where better to be for a World Cup than Brazil, with its incredible football culture, with its fantastic weather, with its wonderful friendly people, with its extraordinary culture, its great food, and all these iconic stadiums. I mean, an image that sort of sticks in my mind from the tournament was, I think the second game that I covered at the Maracanã, it was Argentina against Bosnia. And I'd been up in Manaus in the Amazon for England, Italy. That was the first game that I did. And then I flew down to Rio. And I think I might have just gone straight to the stadium. And I tried to learn Portuguese in preparation for the tournament. I'd actually gone to Brazil the previous summer for the Confederations Cup, and I'd had about a month of Portuguese lessons before that, and it hadn't really got me anywhere. And I got to Brazil the second time, and I thought, right, I'm ready to start speaking Portuguese to people. As it happened, my Portuguese was nowhere near good enough. I was sort of thrown by people's accents a lot, and I couldn't pick up the colloquialisms. But when I arrived in Rio on this evening, I jumped in a taxi, and for whatever reason I just managed to understand what the taxi driver was saying, and we had quite an enjoyable conversation about the tournament and about Brazil and about their chances. And and he was a local. He'd grown up right next to the Maracanã, and as happens at every big tournament, all the streets around the stadium were on lockdown, but he sort of knew all the back routes, and so he got me quite close, and he dropped me off by this stretch of motorway, basically, that had been closed off by the stadium, and it kind of led up towards the Maracanã, and the sun was just sort of, I think the sun was just setting behind the stadium, and I kind of emerged from this back street, and there's just this throng of Argentina fans, in their sky blue and white shirts, all singing, you know, arms around each other's shoulders, heading towards the stadium. And I think for me at that tournament, I really felt that the most important subtext, the most important strand was Lionel Messi and what kind of tournament he'd have. I really felt that that was, you know, I wasn't the only person who thought this, but I, you know, that was a tournament when he was going to really cement his legacy, prove that he could do it on the global stage. So there was, you know, there was that kind of extra anticipation. And I remember walking up that that little patch of motorway with all these Argentina fans and the sun just disappearing behind the stadium, and just thinking, where else would you want to be?
I do consume a lot of football, but in a very kind of analytical way, and that's my job, and that's what I've, you know, made a career of, and etc. But I guess in some ways that might explain why this season speaks so much to me, because it was, you know, almost like the peak of childhood support in football in a way. You know, I was old enough, I was sort of 14-ish, I was old enough to, you know, understand what was going on properly and remember the games and stuff, but young enough that it was literally, you know, I was literally waiting for Tuesday and Saturday every week, because it was, you know, pretty much the only thing that was going on in my life. So I think it holds that kind of almost sort of mystical nostalgia to it that I still think back on. And it's very different to, you know, modern football in a lot of ways. So, I mean, to put it into context, obviously, as I said, we'd come very close the season before. There'd been arguments that Wickham should have gone up because Maidstone had gone out of business. So the bottom tier in the Football League was going to be a team short. But I remember Jimmy Hill was quite vociferous in saying that you shouldn't bend the rules and Wickham weren't going to go up, which, again, I never really forgave him for. But there was a little bit of hesitation going into 92-93. I think, you know, some people worried that the team might, you know, have a hangover from the previous season. But they started off with, I think, winning nine of their first 10 games. The end of that run being a 4-0 away win at Kettering, who were, you know, seen as one of the main rivals. And, you know, they were playing pretty scintillating football. People like Steve Guppy on the wing, Keith Scott, who I heard David Squires mention. Swindon signed him from Wickham the following season. But, I mean, he possibly wasn't the greatest striker the Premier League's ever seen, but he was one of the best strikers the conference has ever seen. He was pretty much unplayable. People like Dave Carroll, Keith Ryan, who stayed with the club for another decade after we went up and was still playing for Wickham in the FA Cup run and obviously scored in the semi-final against Liverpool. So, you know, it was a really solid team. And I think the thing to remember as well is that they were part-time. So the season before, they'd gone toe-to-toe with Colchester, who were a professional team. And Wickham players, even that season and this season, trained two nights a week, and that was it. So, you know, they all had proper jobs. The captain, in fact, was injured for the second half of the season because he worked in a factory in Milton Keynes and someone ran over his foot with a forklift truck. And kind of really badly damaged his Achilles, so he was out for half the season. So that's, you know, not an injury that most footballers nowadays would be at risk from, I imagine.
Football just became a little bit too athletic for me. I think some of it now, I mean, if you look at, for example, Manchester City and certainly some of the Pep teams and some of the other chilly teams that Bielsa's put together of people who are intensely fit, but play this wonderful possession-based, frantic, attacking, exciting football. I think that's terrific. But I still think there have been way too many hard runners in football who have been. I was going to say stealing a living. That's well unfair. But that's what my dad labels professionals. People who aren't particularly good at football, but they know how to play football. They know how to play football very well. And it can be just kind of. I mean, it's like there's a great quote from Eduardo Galeano. It says the technocracy of professional sport has managed to impose a football of lightning strength, lightning speed and brute strength, a football that negates joy, kills fantasy and outlaws daring. And I mean, it's typically quixotic of Galeano because that's who he is, but something about that just really resonates with me. And I think Riquelme just for so long stood in opposition to that. I mean, when football was becoming more and more so visceral, and the academy just stood resolutely cerebral. Like, no, I'm not going to just be fit. I'm not just going to run. I'm not just going to work my ass off. There's something more. There's something more for us to be pursuing through football, you know, because, I mean, more people play football each weekend around the world than do anything else, I'm sure. Like, football's a leading mode of culture. Like, and I think for lots of us, or maybe not for lots of us, but I think for many of us, I think football, I think we can learn a lot about humanity and about culture and about the world through football, because the way that people play football in different countries is a social expression. It's a cultural expression. It expresses who we are. And I think Riquelme, I think there's a great dichotomy in Argentine football between the 10, Riquelme, and the 5. They're the two most revered positions in all of Argentinian football and have been for many, many, many decades now. And I think it's a great contrast.
I mean, I was relatively well travelled compared to some of my mates at school at the time. You know, I think my dad is a bit of a hippie, so spent a lot of time backpacking around Europe and stuff. So I was kind of, you know, obviously a very working class guy, but very invested in the idea of opening your mind to different cultures and travelling around when you can. So as a family, although we weren't, you know, anywhere near wealthy or rich in any way, you know, my old man would always find a way for us to travel somewhere, be it, you know, if it might be camping in France, it might be going to Cyprus for a holiday because we lived in a Cypriot community, in North London. So my dad was keen for us to actually go to Cyprus so I could speak to my friends at school about their country and experience their culture. So the idea of going over to France was exciting, of course, because I'd never watched a football game at 18 internationally. And to think of doing that, you know, for this very special occasion of seeing Jamaica there was hugely attractive, and hence the massive disappointment when the phone would just keep ringing and ringing. And I remember it was a big theme at the time. It was all over the news because obviously England were at the 98 World Cup and everyone was experiencing the same thing. And, you know, interestingly, in and around the communities of Tottenham and Haringey, where I was brought up, everyone was experiencing the same thing.
Although I'm talking about summer of 81, the first match I ever went to see was in September 81, only a month after this sort of coming of age or enlightenment, where I'd sort of got into football. But it was even then, as a 6-year-old, I was desperate. I remember being desperate to go the previous weekend, saying, "Oh, what, you can actually go to matches? Can we go to a match? Can we go to a match?" And then I think it was like the third weekend of September. My dad took my brother and me to a match, and you know, we were. I grew up in Cheshire, and it was, well, it's always been the case, really. But at that particular time, there were probably 7 top flight teams eight top flight teams within about an hour or an hour and a half of us. You know, the 2 Merseyside clubs, 2 Manchester clubs, Stoke, West Brom, Wolves, Aston Villa, Birmingham as well, so 9. And my dad would sort of look in the paper at the fixtures on a Saturday morning. And you could do this then because there were tickets readily available. You couldn't possibly do it now, but he would sort of decide on, let's go to Everton against West Ham today. Let's go to Man United against Aston Villa today. Let's go to Wolves against Liverpool, whatever. It would be, and we just go down a motorway and we'd go, and it would be amazing. It probably cost about £6 for the three of us or something like that. And as I said, you can't do it now, but I remember that the first match we went to was Stoke against Nottingham Forest on a Saturday afternoon, 1981, September 1981. And it was just, again, like, I don't know. I mean, now how everything is filmed, and you can see how kids react to opening their Christmas presents and going to Disneyland and stuff like that. I wish I had some kind of footage of me going into the Victoria Ground and Stoke for the first time, or to Old Trafford or Anfield or Villa Park or wherever the first time. I just remember just being absolutely gobsmacked.
I was 17. I was born in 1971 when Arsenal won the double. And I've grown up hearing about that team and what it meant, and slightly in awe of the fact that Arsenal had a team that was able to win the league, because as most people of a certain age will know, the majority of the 70s and 80s were heavily dominated by Liverpool, with a few little exceptions with odd teams. I'm sure that you'd want to mention Everton, yeah, being amongst them, Nottingham Forest and so on, who had their moments. But, you know, it was the era of Liverpool. And I remember being 17 and thinking, idiotically, you know, if you could see your team in the league once, you can die happy, sort of thing. That, yeah, you know, it was something to strive for and hope for and dream about, even if you didn't think it was necessarily that realistic.
Yeah.
And to suddenly find the team that you follow up there was tremendously exciting. And it was a young and hungry team, and George Graham, who's the manager at the time, did an incredible job in harnessing hunger.
Yeah.
In as much as he was a great tactician, and he drilled them brilliantly.
My favourite memory probably changes every morning I wake up. There's a new memory, but my favourite moment, while I'm thinking of a memory, my favourite moment will never change. And I'm not ashamed to say, and I think all football fans will realise this, I'm not ashamed to say I've had the conversation with my wife and my son, and the moment my wife said, yes, I'll marry you, was a wonderful, wonderful moment. The moment my child was born, my son, who I love more than life, was a wonderful moment. But they realise, and they've come to understand and accept, that there's one moment in my life even better than that. And if you're not a football fan, you're probably best not listening now, because you won't understand this. You'll think, why on earth is a man choosing a football man? But it's the moment, the 1990 FA Cup semi-final, where Crystal Palace, we've been beaten 9-0 by Liverpool, earlier that season at Villa Park, we're about to beat Liverpool 4-3. It's one of the biggest upsets in football history, let alone FA Cup history, even though we're in the same division. And I'm sure, I'm convinced, because of where I was standing in the crowd, we're all moving all over the place, we're still standing. I'm convinced I was the first person to see the referee raise his whistle to his lips. So I started celebrating a split second before everybody else. The 2 seconds after the referee blew the whistle was our first trip to Wembley. It was a remarkable game. That, without a doubt, was the best moment of my life. Because the build-up to it was incredible. No, we couldn't win. It was impossible for us to win, simple as that. And then all the omens were terrible. It's one of the best Liverpool teams ever. And it was coming to the end of that great period of domination. But they were one of the best Liverpool teams ever. Player for player, they were better than us all round. They were a better team than us, they had a better history. They'd beaten us, as I say, 9-0 on one of the most humiliating nights of my life. It was awful. Even before the game, they had an RAF dog display demonstration, which was great. You kind of go, you're in there early enough to say, we'll see the RAF dog display. And they got all the Liverpool fans to cheer for this dog that had a little red jacket on. And the dog in a little red jacket officially broke the record for the course on the pitch. Broke the record, fantastic. They got Palace fans to cheer for the dog in a blue jacket who fell off the plane. People think this was a time, a more innocent time, when they were happy for a dog display team to be going on the pitch. Literally minutes before one of the biggest games in football that year. So they set up the course and it's great. It was like, and the Liverpool dog, yeah, even we had to applaud the Liverpool dog. He was a beast. I mean, he just went around his court. It was fantastic. And the Palace dog fell off. And it's one of those moments when you just go, this is not going to go well, is it?
Yeah, but it puts life into context, doesn't it? It's one of those moments, and I see people in my business that stress, and it's not, it's just a job. You talk about football and you ask people questions, and it's an entertainment business, and at the end of the day you're there to promote the product and to entertain people. You know, you read Twitter and people get upset about football. It's an escape from reality. You know, and you said before, do you get nervous? No, I don't. You just go in there and you're talking about a football match, and you know, if I was going and talking about volleyball or chess or something I didn't know about, then I'd be nervous because I'd just be making it up. But you know, you've done your work. So no, it's an escape from life. And then, you know, a moment like that on the 10th of July 1994 should have been the greatest moment of my career at that point, but everything is overshadowed and it's all a bit of a blur. And intentionally, until tonight when we Wikipedia'd and Googled it, I didn't know the specifics. I couldn't remember who they were playing. I knew it was Sweden. I knew they're going to think play Bulgaria. And I remember it was a decent Romania team as well. I knew it was penalties because all that was important, but it was completely unimportant in the greater kind of spectrum of things.
At what point did you said you had the flashing? Were you, when you got back to the hotel room and when you've done this? How much, if you don't mind me asking, how much was the crash from? I mean, obviously
if I really didn't realise, we went up, I only went up because I was missing a pair of socks. I had everything else with me and I went to get a pair of socks. Otherwise, I might have been 3 or 4 hours later.
Yeah.
And those days, there were no mobile phones and nobody. So it was only by pure chance I saw the light flashing on the room. And then I went down and they're going, where have you been? Come on, the coach is going. I said, well, I've just become a dad. What? Oh, it's kind of months away. Well, one of the other guys is expecting I think it was a daughter he eventually got at roughly the same time. And we've been kind of clothes shopping for babies and stuff like that, but you're buying for babies that are £8 or £9. Junior behind me is £1.14 when he was born, and his brother was £1.12. So you couldn't prepare for any of that. And the bizarre thing was, we went off and it was ITV and BBC against the foreign broadcasters, and I played in goal and played a football match. So it was still an anomaly to that night. Then we had this incredible thunder and lightning, and the game was called off after 60 minutes. It was like nothing was normal. Then we went and had a Chinese, and I think I was powerless because I couldn't get out of Dallas, and my passport was in Minnesota because I'd been rushed to Dallas to do the game, thinking I can get back at a leisurely pace. And time kind of, and I still remember, and it's somewhere in the house, getting Dr. Spock's book on raising babies, which was the thing at the time. There was nothing in there about 16-week or 15-week premature babies. So nothing was normal. So, you know, as I say before, it's a little bit like the job. You've got to prepare, but you know, you've got to be prepared for absolutely everything at the same time as well.